was more than just some hick from Elwyn. He was a big-time player. As a freshman, he played 3 varsity sports, and in the spring had been recruited for track when the coach, Dale Sloan, saw him play football. After watching in awe as Schartzer sprinted away from a gang of would-be tacklers, Sloan decided the cocky freshman might already be the fastest kid at Macon High. In truth, he was underestimating Steve. Soon, Schartzer would prove to be the fastest kid in the county. On the diamond, Schartzer hit over 300 as a freshman and drove in the winning run in the game that clinched the conference title. He practiced hard, beat himself up when he made mistakes, and took the game more seriously than the other boys. In many respects, Schartzer and his new coach couldn't have been more different. Schartzer brimmed with energy, ready to go to war at a moment's notice. Of all the Iron Men, he enjoyed Burns' patent speeches the most. He also didn't suffer fools kindly. When a new basketball coach took over the junior high team in 8th grade and began his first practice with a happy talk demonstration about how, "Look, boys, 2 balls can fit through this rim," Schartzer smelled bullshit and stood up to interrupt him. "What's your point?" Schartzer said. "Isn't the object to put the damn ball in this damn rim?" "Well, yes, Steve," the coach said. "Well, when are we going to do that? That's what I came out here for." If Schartzer treated the game like a military engagement, Sweet seemed to see it more as a great adventure. Already, in only a month, he'd not only changed most of the team rules, who made practice optional for God's sake, but had, at various times, joined the boys during scrimmages, held home run derby during practice, and doled out nicknames to players. Schartzer was wary. If this was coaching, it was unlike any he'd received. The following Saturday, Tomlinson took the mound for the Ironmen against Assumption. The sun hid behind the clouds, and the temperature again fell below 40. But at least there was no wind. The Assumption hitters probably wished there had been. Without it, they stood no chance against Tomlinson, who launched fastball after fastball. Assumption never got a man past second base, and Macon won 8-0. The following afternoon, against Argenta, the result was even more lopsided. Schartzer and Atterbury crushed home runs, and the game was called at 13-3 on account of the 10-run mercy rule, which took effect after 5 innings. The boys and Sweet could rest easy. They'd regained their groove. Granted, neither opponent had been in their conference, but wins were wins. A week later, the Iron Men's first real challenge loomed. On April 15th, Macon readied for its first road trip of the season, a 45-minute drive to Moroa High School, north of Decatur. As usual, getting ready was something of an ordeal. Released from class an hour early, the boys hurried through the basketball gym, past the purple mats bearing Iron Men in white letters, underneath the American flag, and into the tiny locker room. Narrow and cramped, it contained 3 rows of gray lockers, 2 skinny wooden benches, 1 toilet, and a communal shower. The boys crammed in and dressed as quickly as they could. It was uncomfortable, but still better than football season, when the team gave up on the space entirely and erected black curtains on the basketball court, which some boys chose to selectively ignore, the better to show off their torsos for any teenage girls who happened to walk by. Once dressed, the boys jogged out to the parking lot, where the long yellow bus was already idling. Behind the wheel, beaming and welcoming them in a mock tour bus tone, was Sweet. Unable to get funding for a bus driver, he figured he'd just do it himself. As Sweet steered the creaky bus, bumping over 2-lane country roads, the players laughed, joked, and tried not to get carsick. Toward the back of the 20-odd rows of vinyl seats, one boy sat quietly. Hat pulled down over reedy brown hair, John Henneberry stared out the window, thinking about everything that could go wrong in this, his first pitching start of his high school career. By far the least imposing kid on the team, Henneberry was neither tall nor strong. To the untrained eye, A good 40% of his body mass appeared to be elbows and knees, and his delicate features and thin face only added to the impression. He was the worst-hitting regular on the team, bereft of power or speed, and Swede regularly batted him ninth. Especially following Tomlinson and Scherzer in the rotation, he looked like a JV pitcher summoned for a spot start. His fastball, if you could call it that, floated in at a leisurely pace, as if taking in the surroundings en route. As Scherzer liked to say, Hennebery had three speeds, slow, slower, and slowest. The Moroa field, like most in the Meridian Conference, presented unique challenges. The infield consisted entirely of grass, and home plate sat at the intersection of a cow pasture and a cornfield. The left side of the diamond was also the football field, so batters hit from one end zone toward the other. In lieu of a left field fence, a tall row of apple trees buttressed the four-story brick edifice of the high school 400 feet out. Pursuing balls in deep left required navigating a runoff depression that became so soggy during the rainy season that one football player is said to have almost drowned when opponents piled on top of him for too long. Right field, on the other hand, was a lefty hitter's dream, flat and exceptionally short, ending about 250 feet out where South Cedar Street provided an asphalt barrier. As Hennebery walked to the mound for warm-ups, the Moroa hitters took casual swings and talked among themselves. Until, that is, they got a load of Hennebery lofting pitches toward the plate, each as soft and fluttery as the last, as if made of papier-mâché. One by one, the Moroa boys turned and began to watch. That's his fastball? Within minutes, they were visualizing monster home runs, 4-for-4 stat lines, and the cute girls would be impressed by them. One even said it out loud. We're going to rock this guy. On the mound, Hennebery could hear the Moroa players, and it brought back bad memories. More than any of the Macon boys, he was a self-made player. From the time he was 5 years old, throwing dirt clods and walnuts on his grandfather's farm in Decatur, Hennebery had dreamed of being a pitcher. By the time he was 7, his father had fashioned a backstop out of a couple of steel posts and chicken wire, and the two played catch in the yard every afternoon, until the light got so dim that bats swooped around John's pitches. All that practice couldn't overcome a core problem, though. John just couldn't throw the ball very hard. During his first couple seasons of Little League, opponents teed off on his fastball, and one game after another ended with Hennebery walking off the field with his head down. And now, for the third time in 3 seasons, John had to try to make a good impression on a new coach. And this time, it mattered. He'd barely played during his freshman year, and had lost his sophomore year to mono. Not that he would have pitched anyway, since the Ironmen had Tomlinson, Scherzer, and a senior named Ray Martin. The first Moroa batter stepped in, eager to get a crack at Macon's goofy-looking pitcher. On the mound, Hennebery knew how important this first pitch was. As someone who relied on finesse, he needed to have his good stuff right away, or the game could spiral out of control. Beginning his slow windup, he kicked his leg high and twisted at the hip, as if all that motion might somehow generate more velocity. Then released the ball. It sailed in, headed toward the hitter's chest, then, bam, fell right out of the air. The boy swung as hard as he could. He missed by a foot. The next pitch never even entered the strike zone, but it looked so tantalizing that the Moroa hitter took another cut. When the third offering started nearly head high, yet somehow looped in for strike 3, the boy was pissed. He headed back to the dugout grumbling. The next batter fared no better, nor did the next. All went up looking for fastballs. None saw one in the strike zone. Instead, Hennebery delivered a steady stream of junk. The breakthrough had come one night years earlier while watching the Game of the Week on TV. John heard Dizzy Dean refer to a curveball as the Great Equalizer, and immediately asked his father about it. Knowing little about the pitch, Jack Henneberry canvassed his co-workers at the post office until he found one who'd played ball in college and could teach him a proper curve. That night, Jack returned home and took his son out to the backyard, where they practiced throwing hooks for hours. It wasn't pretty at first. John had trouble gripping the ball, and, even once he could, had no luck controlling the pitch. Errant breaking balls sprayed the Henneberry lot, some so far off target that Jack considered building a bigger backstop. Slowly, though, John began to get the hang of it. Within a year, his pitches were dipping and darting, sometimes even by design. By the fifth grade, after his family moved to Macon from Decatur, John felt confident enough with his new weapon to use it in a Little League game. At the age of 10, he threw his first no-hitter. Now he relied on the curveball the way most kids did their heater. Packing the ball back in his hand, he delivered it from a 70-degree angle, holding the pitch out from his body to get more torque. He could throw curves early in the count, late in the count, or when he needed a strikeout. When he was going good, he could even aim for specific spots in Dean Otta's glove. Most of the time, the pitch did what he wanted. When it didn't, well, hence his reputation as a notoriously poor batting practice pitcher. If he spun one up there and it didn't break, it usually ended up popping the batter. Already, Mike Atterbury had dislocated the middle finger on his left hand during batting practice while smacking down a Henneberry breaking ball that never broke. They were all snapping today, though. On the sideline, Sweet watched, rapt. By the time Henneberry racked up his 12th strikeout of the game in the seventh inning, Sweet was a believer. Not only had Henneberry allowed only two hits in shutting out Moroa 5-0, he'd done so in what Sweet considered an exquisitely entertaining manner. As the game went on, the Moroa boys had become increasingly agitated, cursing after each strikeout. "He ain't got shit," one muttered on his return to the dugout. Sweet thought this so wonderful that sometime later he bestowed upon Henneberry an unofficial nickname, "Ain't Got Shit." To Sweet, it not only summed up the boy, but in some respects, the whole team. By mid-April, Macon boasted an impressive 5-1 record, but that wasn't what caught the attention of Joe Cook. Rather, he was more interested in how the Iron Men had won those games. As preps writer for the Decatur Herald and Review, Cook covered roughly 100 schools, from Lincoln in the north all the way down to Olney and Greenville in the south. He knew most every highway and back road in central Illinois, and was always on the lookout for potential feature stories. Upon glancing at Macon's schedule, he suspected he'd found one. He checked the box scores, then checked them again and came to the same stunning conclusion. Not only were the Iron Men undefeated through four conference games, but they had yet to give up a run. What's more, in six games total, Macon had yet to allow an earned run, period. 42 innings and a 0.00 team ERA. Even in an area where it seemed every team had an ace, this was a remarkable feat, especially coming from a school with little to no baseball history. Cook picked up the phone and called Macon High, whereupon he asked to speak with a baseball coach, a man by the name of L.C. Sweet. This was a story he needed to hear. The next morning, the residents of Macon opened up their papers to see a headline in the sports section that read, "How Sweet It Is." The article, which filled a good quarter of the page, mentioned Tomlinson, Henneberry, and the Ottas, as well as a boy identified as sophomore John Schartzer, a mistake Steve Schartzer proceeded to take as a personal affront. A full half of the piece, however, was devoted to Macon's first-year coach, whom Cook depicted as a quirky, candid, fun-loving bachelor in his mid-20s who got the baseball job by forfeit. Sweet was quoted as saying, "I wasn't too excited about doing the job at first, but it's been a very enjoyable season." When asked about his coaching acumen, Sweet deferred to the boy's talent. "As for his own priorities," said Sweet, "I'm still an English teacher first." This may have been true, but baseball coach was becoming an awfully close second. In one game after another, Macon prevailed. The boys crushed Niantic 10-0, Moequa 9-2, and prevailed 4-2 over arch-rival Mount Zion, a team the Ironmen hadn't beaten in years. Sweet's boys were bordering on dominant. By now, the team had fallen into a loose rhythm, egged on by Sweet, who not only spent a good chunk of practice joking with the boys, but nearly all of it on the field. At first, the players weren't quite sure what to make of it. Coaches were supposed to stand on the side with a whistle, chewing them out. But here was Sweet, taking his cuts, running in the outfield, and throwing batting practice most every day. And what a BP pitcher he was. Hanaberry remembers it as, like having a pitching machine. Even though some of the balls were torn up, with the stitching loose and the cover flapping, Sweet had tremendous control. If you needed confidence, he could groove one. If you had trouble with outside pitches, he put one fastball after another on the outside corner. And if you got too cocky, as Hanaberry says, he could gun you down. Sweet pitched because he enjoyed it, but also for strategic reasons. Whereas most teams in the area employed their starting pitchers to throw batting practice, Sweet tried to dissuade his from doing so. "What's the point of that?" he said to Hanaberry and Schartzer. "Why would I want you to learn to throw the ball so guys can hit it?" So instead, it was Sweet up on the mound, throwing sometimes an hour a day, possessed of a seemingly rubber arm. The fielders got practice in live game situations. The hitters got to face pitching from someone who'd competed at the semi-pro level. And Sweet got to play ball. "It was amazing," says Hanaberry. "How much better we got." There was only one cardinal sin during practice. Getting too serious. "Gentlemen," Sweet said whenever this occurred, "we are here after school because we are no longer in school. This is the fun part." If that didn't work, he had other means. Once, when he sensed the kids getting too testy, he went into his windup and, upon swiveling, turned and mooned the boys. Day by day, the players became more accustomed to both Sweet's unconventional approach and his seemingly limitless confidence in them. During games, they took off running whenever they wanted, often with great success. They bunted when they saw an opportunity and pitched out when it seemed prudent. Instead of deputizing a parent to be the first base coach or bringing in an assistant, Sweet named Hanaberry to the job. He did this in part because Hanaberry was a part-time player, but also because he knew the responsibility would boost the boys' confidence, which Sweet saw as the ultimate goal of much that he did. During games, no matter how bad Tomlinson, Schartzer, or Hanaberry looked on the mound, Sweet left them in. "You'll work through it," he said. Or if they appeared tight, he pulled them aside between innings and asked them why they played baseball. If the boys looked back at him blankly, he smiled and said, "Because it's fun." And then, without discussing strategy, he walked away. Schartzer, in particular, was warming to Sweet's methods. If the new coach had come in and said, "Drop down and give me 20, Schartzer's response would have been, "You pitch this ball. I do more push-ups and sit-ups at home when I'm done than you do all week. Don't give me that." But Sweet felt more like a mentor than an authority figure. Despite his laissez-faire attitude, he also struck Schartzer as a man who knew baseball, respected the game, and understood that coaching was about discovery, not dictates. "Try holding the bat in your fingertips so you're quicker and stronger, and they can't throw it by you on the inner half of the plate," Sweet told him. "Or, when you're hitting, pretend you're on the mound. What would you be throwing here? Why? Then be ready for it." The proof, as Schartzer liked to say, was in the goddamn pudding. The team was piling up victories. Winning games was one thing, though. Gaining respect was another. By May 9th, when the Ironmen hosted Argenta, they were 10-2 and on the verge of the postseason. It was a gusty afternoon, and the wind blew northeast, out toward left field, giving wings to any ball pulled down the line. It was Henneberry's turn on the mound, and after three innings he was already in a 4-1 hole. Then, in the top of the fourth, a tall, muscular Argenta player named Mike Ferrell stepped to the plate with two men on. It was one of those days when Henneberry's off-speed pitches were wandering